Okay, everyone. So, as usual, just talk a little bit about meditation practice and then do some meditation together afterwards. Yesterday I was talking a little bit about the power of metta practice to set us free from so many of the problems in life, some of the attachments that we have and emotional involvements and loneliness and all of these things that are so common and so problematic in the world. And so I thought I'd talk a little bit about metta practice today and how to actually see if we can make it work properly. So the idea behind this is that we want to see the positive qualities in the people around us. That's kind of what metta really boils down to, and rejoicing in the good things. But at the same time, to be able to do that, you also kind of have to let go of all the bad qualities, anything that which you may perceive as bad in other people. So very often we have to start off with kind of feeling if there's anything, we have any problems with anyone, any kind of unresolved business, and sort that out first of all. This is actually straight from the suttas, the way this is explained. The way to do this is very simple, and that's to understand that any kind of negativity or bad qualities we may perceive in other people, it's always those qualities are always there because of delusion, misunderstanding, wrong outlook. And it's not really that these people are kind of deliberately being evil, but they are just led by habits and circumstances and conditioning. And so the correct response to anything bad is always compassion. Because there's darkness there, there's misunderstanding, there's delusion, there's a wrong grasp of what really makes for happiness in this world. And that is kind of one of the foundations for making metta practice work, that we can let go of any negative ideas about other people. And then once you do that, then it kind of opens up the path to seeing the goodness, because then we can rejoice in the good qualities that are there. And to do this, one of the ways of doing this is to take different groups of people and seeing different groups of people like as an overall rather than focusing on individuals. And kind of the typical groups you might want to focus on are things like your Kalyanamittas, your good spiritual friends. There's so many people like this when you're practicing on the Buddhist path. And just pick out a few. And the people who kind of inspire you the most. And remember the qualities in these people. And then when you remember the good qualities in people who are really inspiring because of their conduct, it kind of has a natural uplifting effect. And that is really the beginning of metta practice. And then you can wish them well or whatever. But just that feeling, that appreciation of the good qualities in other people already is very uplifting. And I mentioned, the Friday before, I mentioned this beautiful little sentence in the suttas where you look upon your fellow monastics or your fellow Kalyanamittas with the idea, wow, I'm so fortunate to have friends like this. And if you can really feel that, if you can really feel that kind of emotion, that you're fortunate to have such good spiritual friends, that's kind of extraordinary. That's remarkable. And that is really metta. That is goodwill. That is friendliness. It is love in a sense. And that kind of really becomes the kind of pathway to these emotions. We can do the same thing with members of the Sangha. You can think of the Sangha as a group, the monastic community. Some people find that easier. Some people find it more difficult. But you can, if that's kind of your avenue, you can. Then again, you can take some Sangha member who has really inspired you, who you see lots of good qualities in, and you can kind of allow yourself just to be lifted up by just focusing on those good qualities. And you can wish the Sangha, based on that idea of this one person and knowing that there are probably other Sangha members like that, wish that Sangha again well and happiness and good fortune, whatever it is. So your Kalyanamittas is a group you can focus on. You can also just focus on ordinary people, ordinary people in the world with the knowledge that there are lots of good people around, often invisible people, and seeing those good qualities in ordinary people, and then wishing them well as a consequence of those good qualities and seeing that in them. You can even use the devas. I don't know if you have any relationship with the devas. If you have a relationship with the devas, you can wish the devas well, yeah, and see all of these beautiful beings that have been reborn in a good place because of their good actions, because of their good qualities. You can use the animal realm, yeah, because this now we're moving more towards compassion in a sense, but compassion and metta are very closely related to each other. It can be hard to really separate them fully. So you can also use the animal realm and just see the vulnerability and all these animals who really suffer for no particular reason of their own. And they're just that suffering, and then wishing them well, wishing them happiness, wishing them freedom from that particular state. This is kind of the idea of metta practice, and it's good because it trains us in seeing the good qualities in people around us. Even if it doesn't give rise to very powerful feelings, it can still be useful, something you can then bring into your life otherwise, and kind of enhance and improve your practice as a consequence. Okay, so let's try to do some meditation together here. Okay, so please just start out the meditation in the usual way, just by relaxing, being comfortable, finding that ease, and just gradually allowing the world to fade away, and just enjoying the peace and the good atmosphere right here at the Buddhist Society. And please remember to be the passive observer in your meditation, just sitting back, allowing the world and your mind just to float by, just by itself, without any kind of involvement. The less involved you are, the quicker is the path to peace, the quicker everything calms down. And now, if you wish, bring up the idea of your favorite Kalyanamitta, someone you respect for the wonderful, marvelous spiritual qualities, and just focus on those qualities for a short while, and then thank them for being such a wonderful guide and inspiration in the world, and find that gratitude within yourself for having people like this in your life to help you forward and to walk forward on this wonderful path. And as you build up that positive perception, and take your meditation from there. Okay, so coming close to the end, before we come to the end, just take a few moments just to reflect on your meditation here today. And if you do feel more at ease, more mindful, more clear, more joyful, having more metta, whatever it is, ask yourself why that is the case. And if it hasn't worked, ask yourself again why that might be the case. Okay, yes, that's the end of the meditation, so please sit comfortably. Okay, are there any questions or comments here today? Anyone want to say anything? Everyone supremely happy. Okay. That's wonderful. Okay. So is there anything from anything else? Yeah. Okay. Okay. Thank you. Okay, so we have a few questions. This is from someone called Peace Calm. Dear Ajahn, what is feeling and what should we do about it? Is depression a feeling? What should we do about the bad feelings like sadness, anxiety, fear or doubt? Is feeling important in Buddhism? Yes, feelings are not only important in Buddhism, they are important in life, because feelings are what make life worthwhile one way or the other. Good feelings make life worthwhile, bad feelings make life kind of unbearable, you know, so feelings are obviously very, very important. The things that you are talking about here are what we might call emotions, and emotions obviously very important. In Buddhism, the idea of feeling is just a reference to whether a particular a moment or particular mental state is positive, negative, or neutral. That's really all it means in Buddhism. So whenever you feel positive state, it's a good feeling. If it's a negative state, it's bad feeling. If it's somewhere in between, it's a neutral feeling. So there's a difference there between emotions and feelings in Buddhism. But generally speaking, bad emotions are bad feelings. Good emotions are good feelings, you can say. So the idea, whole purpose of Buddhism is to develop more good feelings. The idea of the whole Buddhist path is to overcome dukkha or suffering. So it's to develop positive feelings. So the idea of metta practice or doing things like the contemplation of the Buddha or the Sangha or whatever it is, all of these things develop kind of joy and happiness when it works. It has to work, of course, and that is the purpose of the whole Buddhist path. The whole of meditation is about ultimately developing good feelings. Two kinds of good feelings in particular, joy and tranquility. These are the two main aspects of good feelings on the path of meditation. Tranquility and joy. Joy and tranquility. Is depression a feeling? Depression is like a negative feeling, right? So you want to not try too hard, but we want to kind of develop out of depression. And it can be done by thinking in a different way, by guiding the mind to look at different things. It's possible to emerge from that depression. What should we do about bad feelings like sadness, anxiety, fear, doubt? Again, you have to develop out of these things. There are things you can do in the moment to help you overcome these things. But most of these things have to be developed out of over the long term. There usually aren't any quick fixes in life. There's no kind of magic bullets or anything like that. You have to go very slowly and come out of these things. But things like fear and anxiety are really about, it's like looking at the future in a negative way. Yeah, anxiety and fear is always about the future. And one of the beautiful things about spiritual practice is that your future is a bright one because you're living in a good way. So that will automatically reduce that anxiety and fear if you practice in a spiritual way and you understand what you're doing. Sadness, well, sadness again is about how we deal with life, yeah, and how we think about the world. You may feel sad because of climate problems. You may feel sad because someone in your family is ill. You may feel sad for all kinds of reasons. And again, this can be overcome by thinking about the world in the right way. We talk a lot about these things here at the Buddha Society, so maybe have a look at some of the old talks talking about these things. Doubt, on the other hand, doubt is okay. Doubt can be good or bad. But sometimes there are doubtful things, and if there are doubtful things, then doubt is appropriate. But you want to, in certain areas, you want to minimize doubt, and the way to minimize doubt is often to learn more and to investigate and to understand. Okay, next question. This is from Scott Barty. Dear beloved Ajahn, okay, that's very kind of you. How have you effectively understood perception in your experience? Well, perception is how we understand the world, right? Perception is our ability to actually make sense of anything. So when you hear these sounds, you are perceiving them as meaningful sentences, hopefully. It's not just noise, right? When someone speaks, it actually is something meaningful that is being transmitted. Otherwise, you have kind of no point in talking if you can't transmit anything. So reasonably meaningful or funny or something which has an effect on others. And that is perception that actually creates meaning out of sound. Or when you see something, yeah, you see things around you. I mean, if, you know, I could just see a kind of vast amount of colors and shapes or whatever, but no, I see people. I see a roof. I see windows. I see the trees outside. Yeah, very beautiful outside, by the way. I'm really lucky. I'm looking this way. You are looking. Actually, this is a pretty good sight as well, actually. So all of these things are perceptions. We make sense of the world in this way, right? We can understand what is going on around us. That is what perception is about. Differentiating between things and making them friends and enemies. Yeah, good and bad. All of these things are perceptions. They're not given in the world. They are things how we create meaning in the world. Then we have one from Wolfram Gabi from Germany. And Wolfram says, Ayakema talks about meditation using concentration and one-pointedness to explain. Ajahn Brahm did not like those words. What do you say to explain, please? Well, I think the idea Ajahn Brahm has, remember the words come and go in fashion. There is no perfect word. It is how we use them that matters. So sometimes concentration might be okay, because sometimes that is what, you know, we're trying to focus the mind or whatever. But in the present day, the word concentration very often means a forceful effort onto something. You are concentrating really hard, right? And at the end of the day, you are exhausted because you've been concentrating so hard. And that is not what we're doing in Buddhism. We're not forcing the mind on the object. The idea of meditation is to relax, to be at ease, to allow a natural focus. And that natural focus only comes about when you are enjoying what you're doing. And this is why enjoying the meditation is so important, because then the mind is drawn to the object and the whole experience happens automatically. So this is Ajahn Brahm. And I think Ajahn Brahm has a very good point about that, actually. And Ajahn Brahm likes to translate samadhi as stillness. And I think that's a very good word. There are lots of possible translations. What about one-pointedness? I think that's better, because one-pointedness doesn't imply use of force, it doesn't imply willpower, it just implies that the mind is going towards one thing, Yeah, staying with one thing. And that is really what samadhi is about. So I think one-pointedness may not be so bad, but concentration, I can see why he doesn't want to go there. Yeah. Next one is from Rob Donkersloot, whatever. Sorry about that. With everything being impermanent, should we have an expectation of long-term relationships such as marriage lasting? Yeah. No, I would not have that expectation. It depends what you mean. Remember, I mean, one thing is whether marriage lasts while, you know, while we are here, while both partners are alive. That is uncertain enough already. Yeah, I think over 50% of marriages end in divorce these days. Depending on which country you're in, I think in Australia it's over 50%. Many countries, it actually is very high. But, you know, regardless of whether you get divorced in this life or not, you know it's not going to last because you know one of you will have to die. Yeah, one of you will die before the other one. And there you are. It didn't last. So you know it's not going to last. That's absolutely certain. And this becomes even more obvious when you kind of take into account the idea of rebirth. Yeah, you kind of, the marriage doesn't last, but then you get reborn. So you carry on regardless. Then you get into another marriage. That doesn't last. And another marriage. And you kind of go on for this forever. And every time is the same heartbreak, the same problem. The better the marriage is, the greater the heartbreak when kind of things fall apart. It's good to be clear about this because then we can do kind of the something to remedy that problem and we can take practice a spiritual path in a wiser way as a consequence. There's no point in kind of sticking your head in the sand and pretending these problems aren't there because these are real issues. Then we have, more questions, okay. We have a from Diana, okay. What is Nirodha Samapatti? Is it like ninth jhana? Is one an arahant if it happens? So Nirodha Samapatti in the suttas is called Sanya Vidayata Nirodha. It means literally the ending of feelings and perception. And it's pretty hard to imagine what that might be like. If all perception and feeling is gone, it means there's nothing. Everything is gone, basically. There's just nothing. And there's not even the experience of nothing. There literally is nothing here. And that is very, very profound. And if you are able, sometimes it is called the ninth jhana, but really it is not really a jhana at all. It is way beyond that. Is one an arahant if it happens? Not necessarily. According to the suttas, you can be a lesser arya as well, but you will be a noble person for sure. Next one, from Dublin Photo Art and Animation. The Buddha lived in luxury, apparently, until he got sick of having everything he desired. How are we normal people supposed to renounce what we do not have? Yeah, you have to renounce the luxury you haven't got, that's right. The thing is that the Buddha never lived in luxury, right? It was the Buddha to be that lived in luxury here. The Buddha always lived in frugality. He wasn't the Buddha yet when he was living in luxury. I think that's an important point to remember. He got sick of having everything he desired. Well, it's not really that he got sick of having everything he desired. That's not really the point. The point is that he got sick of seeing the unsatisfactoriness of those things. He got sick of seeing their impermanence. He got sick of seeing that all of these things will have to go one day. Why should I attach? Why should I hold on to? Why should I grasp onto, cling onto things that are out of my control and then cause me suffering in the future? He knew that that kind of life will have to cause suffering. That is really the point. That was his insight. And you can read about this in the sutta as you have a look at the Noble Search, Majjhima Nikaya 26. That's exactly what he says. Was the motivating factor that drove him to become an ascetic and live the ascetic life and become the Buddha down the track. Yeah. So it's exactly the same for us. You don't have to have luxury to understand the limitations of luxury. If you understand the limitations of what you have now, whatever that is, then you also understand the limitations of luxury because it's exactly the same thing. If you understand the limitations of your relationships, if you understand the limitations of your humble possessions, if you understand the limitations of your humble status in society, all of these things are impermanent and unreliable and will not last. And then when you understand that, that's when you throw it out. So check out middle-length sayings, Majjhima Nikaya 26, the Noble Search Sutta, and you will see what actually made the Buddha to be renounce his life. And maybe it will have the same effect on you. See what happens. And maybe we'll see you here in Perth with shaven head, ready to don the brown robes, as they say here. We'll see what happens. And we have another last question for today. This is from Zorba MP. Okay. Yes, interesting name, Zorba MP. I'm new to Buddhism. What advice do you give to someone where identification with a persona has fallen away permanently to deepen their practice and keep them on the straight path? I'm not sure what you mean by this. Identification with a persona has fallen away permanently. I sounds like you're an arahant already. Maybe you don't have to do very much. I'm not sure. So it depends what you mean by that. Really the way to test your practice and to see how powerful your insight is really to see how deep your meditation goes. So if you are able to access deep meditation more or less at will, whenever you want, you sit down, you close your eyes, you become very peaceful and calm. You may enter a deep state of meditation. If you can do that regularly, at will, then you know that your insight is also profound. If you cannot do that quite regularly, attending deep samadhi, powerful bliss, absolute stillness, these kind of things, then you know your insight isn't that deep either. So that's the first way to check out how profound your insight really is. It has to have a practical bearing on your life, otherwise it's not real insight. Apart from that, keep on practicing the Noble Eightfold Path. That's everything we have to do. With even if you have gone a long way on this path, if you want to go all the way to the very end, practice the Noble Eightfold Path. Okay, everyone, that's all for today. So let's pay respect to the Buddha Dhamma Sangha.